Accession number 24925, reel 7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Don Anderson in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 18th of the 3rd, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Don, we've been talking obviously about reaching your final op, as you call it. I wanted to come back a little way. You've been talking, obviously, about being involved, flying planes, ACAC, going off. How did you cope with the sort of situation when you were in a plane being shot at, surrounded by ACAC?
Well, I can remember the first time being shot at. I first of all shot at it over Cadiz, but they're a long way away and there's nothing of note. But I remember flying over the Irrawaddy River, and I was number two to the CO, and we're attacking something or other, and these, I think we're attacking boats on the Irrawaddy, and I suddenly saw these ACAC coming towards me. And I suddenly thought to myself, they're trying to kill me. And it's sort of the realization sunk home then. And I found this very annoying. But anyhow, we went on and shot up quite a few things here and there.
In relation to coping with the situation, God, there's not a lot that you can really do about that. How do you sort of cope, given that your job is to just fly straight through it?
Well, we could weave, which means that you could alter course and height slightly, hoping to put off the aim of the people that are shooting at you. And I would weave quite a lot. So much so that my navigators, we had a different navigator most times, they objected strongly to being made airsick. But I persisted. I remember once one navigator said, for goodness sake, don't weave so much. And I said, well, you must remember we're flying over a division of Japanese soldiers and they're shooting at us. And he seemed to think it was all right to weave then.
Your main duties, you mentioned strafing boats.
The main objective in our operation was to cut transport, cut lines of communication from southern Burma up to the Japs at... who were going after Imphal, and their objective was to invade India. So the first part of the Japs were coming up to the north of Burma. Then the second lot of operations I did, they were being driven back to the south. And our job was to cut lines of communication, and at one stage we were briefed to shoot anything that moved that could be of use of transportation. That meant railroads, cars, boats to transport things up north, and even bullock carts. And I don't know anyone who actually shot up a bullock cart, poor old bullock cart, but our idea was to cut all methods of transportation. And we did this by ground strafing. You'd fly over low, over the country, and I say low, be less than 50 feet, which would give you protection against ACAC fire, or anti-aircraft fire. The Japanese bullet in Burma was a 22, very small bullet. They didn't have to carry so much, and we're told their thought was that if they wounded someone, it would take two men to get them off the field. So it was just as effective to wound someone as to kill them. Anyhow, most of us enjoyed the low flying, and you felt comparatively safe. You know, they couldn't see you coming and they couldn't see you going, and you're there a very short time. There were some times when you're out in the open and you had to make a long run at, say, a ferry boat or some such. But all in all, it wasn't too bad.
And the planes you were flying?
They were playing a plane called a Beaufighter, which had was very good for ground strafing in that it had a good forward view, and you're protected on both one side by a great engine and another side by the other engine, and you had a bit of armour plating at the back. You're supposed to keep that closed when you're on operation, but my navigator seemed to enjoy having it open. I don't know whether he could keep his eye on me, I think. But we would low fly, and we had a four 20mm cannon firing forward by the pilot, six machine guns operated by the pilot. They were 303 diameter. Then we had eight rockets, and sometimes we carried bombs as well, so we had quite a good striking power. And if you hit something with a whole lot, it went. And you'd often get cars, you'd see cars, you'd hit them, one, and you'd go around, and all the Japanese would run away, and then you'd blow the car up. Most satisfying, really, in a way.
I'm going to ask you how you sort of worked as a team in that situation, and what it was like
what the team of two aircraft or a team of navigator and a... Well, we always went out with at least two aircraft together. But there were occasions when you'd lose one another. I think I mentioned on my first trip, I lost the CO in a violent rainstorm. As I say, I can remember a sheet of water coming off the main planes, going back about 30 or 40 feet, just a sheet of water. And it was very, very difficult to see. I lost him then. And occasionally you'd lose a person, then you go on and do your own thing. And then working as a team with your navigator, because he would put you on the target, must have been very, very difficult for him to navigate when you're jinking around, changing direction, and he wouldn't get too many pinpoints to get his bearing on flying down low. So all in all, he had a very difficult time. When you're coming back home, it was a bit easier for him in that he would just tell you to head west. And when you're out of the way, he'd get his bearings a bit more than give you another more correct course to fly. And I can remember... I remember one briefing. They used to brief us before we went off on a trip. The CO and the intelligence officer, all in all. And the briefing was rather daunting in that we had to take off, and it was shocking weather. Bomb, or at least ground strafe Rangoon, shoot out the searchlights while the liberators were above throwing their bombs down. They said, now when you come back, if the weather's too bad, get over the top of the station and bail out. And No one was over keen on that off. Anyhow, they decided later, just before we went, the weather was too bad, and they cancelled it, much to everyone's relief. But
when you were sitting, listening to these briefings, was there ever a time when you thought, this one does sound a bit...
Oh, yes. It was now and then as you're going on a dicey do, you're dicing with death, just a sort of an expression they had at the time. This is going to be a dicey do. And there were a few dicey do's, going over aerodromes and ground strafing the planes, this place called Hey Ho. I remember doing a run over Hey Ho. With there were four of us together, and we made a couple of runs and got a few aircraft. I had a bit of trouble on that trip. But I remember I was lining up for an aircraft, but my flight commander was also lining up on the same aircraft, and I could see that if we're going to continue on the course, we're going to crash. So I managed to find a target or two on as AK-AK gun posts. I could see them, so I steered away from him. I kept well away from him. But that was a satisfactory raid. We got a few aircraft, and we all came back.
Did you hear or know of any accidents in relation to when you mentioned Liberators bombing above you or?
Well, no, you see, now the thing is that we were told if you're captured by the Japanese and they ask you questions and they're inclined to torture a bit, they said, you sing like a canary. You tell them all you know. We're going to make it our business that you don't know too much. So all we could have told them about is the squadron we're on, and the type of aircraft, well, they would have known that. We knew very little about what the Liberators were doing, what other squadrons were doing, or where they were operating, or how they were operating. So we were very isolated.
Did that affect you in any way? You never really knew what was going on?
Well, we got the general drift of what was happening, on the radio, BBC. We didn't really know what was happening in Burma because of this policy, I suppose it was, to keep us uninformed so we couldn't divulge anything. And it didn't seem to worry us at all. There was a thing there which I only found out when I was on the squadron. It was called LMF, lack of moral fibre. Now, the thing is that no one can make a pilot take off. He digs his heels in and says, look, I'm not going on this trip. No one can make him go. But you're then inclined to be labelled LMF. And there were a few on our squadron. It wasn't talked about. You'd hear that so-and-so had refused to fly, and they'd be quietly posted away somewhere with their documents stamped LMF. And it wasn't considered to be a good thing to be labelled LMF.
What of those pilots that had enough, the bottle was going, would they be the sort of people that would get LMF?
Yes. Although, strangely enough, the LMF people that I knew wasn't towards the end of their tour. It was probably towards the beginning. Just after they'd seen a couple of ops. I think some people don't like that sort of thing. I can't blame them. I think that if they are either, it's no use sending out someone to do a job if he's in the blue funk. He's not going to do the job at all. And is useless from a point of view of ground striking. So they are just, they're probably well out of it. And I can remember a trip, my 13th trip, and always inclined to be a bit superstitious. And a lot of people carried a mascot with them. And I thought, there's no use me carrying a mascot because I'll probably lose it. And I'll be worried about it. So I decided to grow a moustache. I thought, well, I can't lose that. And that was my... I thought, well, I've got a moustache on, I'll be all right. But I remember on the 13th trip, which is always considered to be a bit of a dicey do, and I was to go out at night and strafe the Tongop Pass. And that was a pass over the hills, mountains, between Tongop and some place in Burma. And I was to try out a flare. The idea was that I'd fire off this flare, I'd see some trucks moving or a movement on the road, I'd fire off the flare, light up the whole area, come in and strafe them. And so I was the first one to try this, and in my excitement of setting off the first flare, I hadn't mentioned it to my navigator. And I sent off this flare, and it was blinding, absolutely blinding, this blinding flash. And the navigator thought we'd been hit, and he screamed out that we'd been hit by ACAC fire, and I... It put me off the stride a bit, and I, by the time I'd gathered myself, and it made you feel very conspicuous with all this light around you, and you thought you were a target. Anyhow, it wasn't a success. I couldn't see the trucks after the light had gone. It blinded me as well as the trucks, and so they didn't use the flares again. So that wasn't that particular. Part of that operation was a dismal failure. But we got back safely.
In relation to the situation, obviously, of going in and strafing a given target, people talk of the isolation that one has in a plane. Did you ever sort of think of the results of your work, as it was?
What the deaths, the other end of the gun? No, not really. No, not really. It was, you seem to be... I think it would be very different to be, in a bayonet charge on the ground, which would be close contact. You seem to be... There was no sense of contact, really. And it didn't worry me. I didn't lose any sleep over it. It was nice to get out there and get the job done. And it was exhilarating, I suppose, really, flying. And let's face it, if you get a 21-year-old with a, give him a very powerful machine with all the armor he had, and just say, go out and shoot up anything you like, it's a wonderful sense of freedom. And I think a lot of people enjoyed it. I didn't mind it at all.
In relation to the sort of consequences, if you had been hit, if you had gone down, did you ever think of what you might do?
Oh yes, we Dick and I planned. You know, we're given rations, an escape kit. I remember being given a pack which included a fishing line, and we used to carry a 38 revolver and a great long hunting knife, and we had a belt full of silver coins, some particular denomination that was, had a high silver content. And the idea was that if we crash landed, we could pay the villagers or whoever, you know, trade with them. And I don't know of anyone who walked out of Burma. No one walked out of Burma. At least from the flying point of view, I think a lot of people at the beginning walked out of Burma, but from being shot down, they're all lost, killed, or prisoners of war. So there's really all the stuff that you're given. We're given bush hats to keep the sun out and walking back and all this. But we knew that you'd have no chance of walking back. The jungle there would be so thick getting back, and you wouldn't know what to do. So everyone considered that if you're hit and you went down, that was it. You're either captured or killed.
You mentioned, obviously, people being shot at. What about actual contact in relation to ACAC, in relation to being shot at and the plane being hit?
What was the contact?
Actually incoming, yeah. Hitting the plane.
Oh, well, yes. Sometimes you could hear it hit definitely. But a lot of times you'd come back from an operation and you'd have bullet holes in the aircraft. It was a metal aircraft, and you wouldn't know where you'd picked them up. And there's the story of Rube Horwood was flying, crossing the coast down near Tungop Pass, and he was hit in the perspex by the side of his neck. And he felt he had been hit in the neck. And he thought it was a gunshot, and he put his hand up to see how bad it was. And of course, he was sweating profusely, and his hand looked at it completely wet with what he thought blood. Of course, it was a little bit of blood and a lot of sweat, and he thought he was dying. And he thought, "Well, I'll keep on going as long as I can." Of course, 2.5 hours later, he was still going, and he realized he got back to. But it must have been most traumatic for him. But there were people who we did have a lot of trouble. I remember a fellow called Trigwell was down in southern Burma there, and he was shot up by the Americans. You'd get a bit of that. We were supposed to maintain complete radio silence. The Americans had the habit of chattering a bit, they'd talk to one another. And this fellow, Wally Trigwell, was shot up. He was about 400 feet, and he was hit by a lightning. Wally Trigwell and his number two were flying low, and a couple of lightnings were above them. They shot his number two down at once, and they hit Wally with these shells. And Wally's navigator, Chippendale, got two 20-millimeter cannon in his back. And Wally crash-landed. And he, of course, poor old Chip died. And then Wally was captured by the Japanese, and he was a prisoner of war for the rest of the... And he said the Japanese didn't treat them too well. He wasn't at all happy with them. But he said that they gave them food, but it's probably just the same food as they gave their infantry, the privates in their infantry. They weren't... and also, tell you what, it was the most interesting thing he pointed out. He said that all Air Force people in Japan and in Burma weren't treated as prisoners of war. They were treated as war criminals. There's a difference. And they're all advised at the end of the war, they'd be tried and they'd be shot. This is because of the strafing and the killing we did. It was, and of course, that didn't happen anywhere else. You weren't treated as a war criminal, you were treated as a prisoner of war. Of course, we didn't know that. You know, when Wally only found that out when he was in the prison.
In relation to comrades being down, not returning, how did you cope with the fact that death was actually a part of war?
I think everyone coped with it quite well. You'd say that in passing, oh, so-and-so is gone, and he didn't come back. And I think the expression was he had bought it. He'd bought his ticket, and he's on his way. As far as I'm concerned, look, thinking of the other people and observing what they thought, they kept it very much to themselves. There's no great... I remember I was going out and we had a padre, a priest, I don't know what sort, and he used to come along and see the fellas and bless them and all that sort of thing before they went. And I didn't like it, really. I said, look, I'd rather not have you bless me and carry on. And the CO found out about it, what I'd said, inadvertently. I don't know how he found out. But anyhow, I wasn't blessed again. And I think the padre left the squadron, actually.
Why did you not want to be blessed?
I didn't think it did me any good. I thought it sort of, I sort of felt that it was inviting death.
A jinx.
Well, I don't know, not a jinx so much. I just didn't want it.
You talk of the sort of superstitious side of being a pilot.
Yeah.
We may have touched on this before, but the sort of gremlins of it all, the things that happen when you're not quite...
Well, you're told all about all sorts of things. Then something happens, will happen that you're not told about. And you say, oh, that's caused by the gremlins. It was an expression they had in the RAF. I don't know if they used it in the RAAF out here, but if there's something wrong with the engine or something was unexplainable, it would be due to the gremlins. Or everyone laughed at it.
Even if it was a lot more likely to be pilot error?
Well, you knew yourself when you were right or wrong. But there are often occasions when the aircraft didn't quite behave. And of course, if you were flying at night, you'd sometimes get this thing called vertigo, which would, you'd feel that completely disorientated. You wouldn't know up or down, or you think when you're flying straight and level, you could swear you're flying at 90 degrees to the ground, at perpendicular, and you have to take a good look at yourself and say, this is not right. You must believe the instruments. And that takes about, sometimes it takes more than others, but probably about 5 minutes and you're over it and you're back to normal.